From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
By the time we hit August, some plants in the garden are a little beat up or have at least needed deadheading or even wholesale cutting back, perhaps. As delicate as they might look texturally from the moment of their first emergence in spring, though, the ones that always startle me by their incredible toughness are the ferns. That's our topic today, ferns, and specifically native ones, with Uli Lorimer of Native Plant Trust, who will tell us some fern lore and some fern care, and even how they reproduce so we can propagate more of them ourselves. More in a moment, but first these messages.
Underwriting support by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, supplying landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners with new ideas and high-quality flower bulbs for fall planting. Plant tulips, plant daffodils, plant Color Blends this fall. Available at colorblends.com.
With me to talk about ferns today is Uli Lorimer, who's made a career of working with native plants. He was longtime curator of the Native Flora Garden at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and in 2019 became director of horticulture at Native Plant Trust, the former New England Wildflower Society and America's oldest plant conservation organization, founded in 1900. Welcome back to the show. How are you up there?
I'm doing very well. So pleased to be back speaking with you.
Yeah, I always look forward to our conversations. I always learn a lot. And before we begin, I just want to remind people two things they may not know about Native Plant Trust in Massachusetts is you have great courses, including a lot of online ones. I see there's one coming up in shade gardening and native plant palettes and more. So we'll give links for people to look at that. But wow, you do a lot of education, don't you?
We sure do. We also have an author talk coming up featuring Daryl Morrison, who I worked with at Brooklyn Botanic Gardens.
Yes.
I'm fortunate to call a friend. And there's information on our website as well to see how you can join in on that particular event where he's going to talk about his new book called Beauty of the Wild.
Which is sitting right here on the left side of my desk right next to me. Yes, very topical, very timely. And the other thing I was going to say to people, in case they're in New England and, you know, or taking a drive or whatever, besides visiting Garden in the Woods and Nasami Farm, your other facility, you sell plants, don't you, at both places?
We sure do. Yeah, so we propagate a lot of natives, a lot of native species. We've got a great availability list of things. If you're in the area, please drop in, visit us in the garden, and take some plants home.
Yeah. Adopt some babies, huh?
Indeed.
So ferns. You have lots of great stories. You always tell me great things, like why is a Christmas fern called a Christmas fern, for instance?
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved ferns for, you know, people have asked in the past, like, what's your favorite plant? And I tend to like to say, what's my current plant crush? Because it sometimes changes.
Right.
But I've always been enamored with ferns. You know, as you said so very elegantly in the beginning, when they first emerge out of the ground, they're beautiful. They look nothing like what they are going to become once they're fully expanded. They're tough. They're very ancient plants. So, and I think they have just a really wonderful calming presence and texture in the garden. I love talking about them. So I'm actually very thrilled that we have a chance to share some of those stories.
So why Christmas, do you think? Why is it called Christmas?
Well,
what is
so
it?
Christmas.
Polysticum acrostichoides, yeah, or some word like that.
Acrostichoides. Yeah, it's a mouthful. But so Christmas fern is an evergreen fern. It's a clump forming fern that's pretty common here in the region. And if you look at the individual frond, the individual pinna, so it's that's one like a little leaflet on the frond, you'll see that it has a little boot shape at one end, and it looks like a Christmas stocking.
Oh,
reasons why it was called Christmas fern, in addition to the fact that it was collected for Christmas wreaths and other things at that time of year. So it's a really wonderful sort of connection with the human uses of this nice plant. And also I think just a cute story that next time you're out there, you can take a look for yourself and take a look at the little stocking as it's called.
Very cute. You told me something else the other day that I didn't know about ferns and their sort of history among protected plants in the United States.
Yes. So a fern is actually the subject of the very first piece of legislation that was ever passed to specifically protect a plant in the United States. And it happened in Connecticut in 1859, I believe. A law was passed outlawing the collection of climbing fern. So this is a very unusual fern called Ligodium palmatum. It kind of behaves like a vine. So it sort of twines around nearby plants. And it was being over-harvested again for Christmas decorations. And so much so that, you know, the folks in Connecticut felt necessary to pass a law outlawing it. And I think at the time, the fine was something like $5, which doesn't sound like a lot now, but in those days, I'm sure it was fairly hefty. Unfortunately, many botanists agree that this plant never really recovered from the over-harvesting that it suffered from at that time. And it's always been an uncommon plant, and in some cases, a very rare plant now, because it also, you know, there's habitat loss and invasive species and all the other reasons and challenges that ferns face. But it's a neat story because, you know, in the United States history, in terms of plant protection laws, a fern was the reason for the very first one.
Well, it's interesting that they led the way in that, because I remember a story about them leading the way in general. Years ago, speaking to the late Dr. Elizabeth Farnsworth, who was with New England Wildflower Society when it was called that, now Native Plant Trust. And she was a fern lover and a fern expert. And she told me, I said, well, so they don't flower, they don't have pollen, they don't have nectar. What's their purpose, you know, in the hat? Like, what's their ecological service that they provide if they're non-flowering plants? And she said, and I'm not quoting, I'm paraphrasing, she said, well, think of all the creatures that can use them as habitat, because they're like ground cover, so to speak, you know, low vegetation. And also, she said, they're early colonizers of disturbed spaces, like ferns march in, kind of, you know, and inhabit the ground. And I had this experience recently. I had to cut down two smallish ornamental trees, things I planted, not big native trees. And so it kind of created this bare space in the shape of a bed, you know, but there wasn't much below them because it had been so shady. And within what seemed like minutes, sensitive fern and I think hay scented is the other one. Just kind of showed up.
No, they're really good at moving into space. Those two particularly. The other thing I find amazing about them is that they're ancient. I mean, we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago that ferns evolved, and, you know, despite the absolute explosion of flowering plants and the diversity of flowering plants, there still are, you know, 15,000 species of ferns and fern allies on the planet. So they're still, you know, quite successful despite, you know, kind of a difficult way that they can reproduce themselves. So I'm just amazed of their sort of staying power in the face of plants that are much better at getting and moving around.
So difficult. So that brings up the subject that we promised you were going to kind of unlock a little bit for us about how do ferns reproduce and what can we kind of learn from that understanding to propagate some ourselves, I guess.
Yeah. So ferns are reproduced via spores. And the strategy is to literally flood the environment with as many spores as possible, knowing that, you know, really only a fraction of 1% will actually result in a viable fern. And so we're talking about literally millions of spores being produced on a single frond. And they're very tiny. And so the way in which those are arranged on the back side of the frond can help you identify them. So the spores have to be released and blown or washed into a favorable place where it can germinate, and it creates this little structure. It's kind of like a heart-shaped leaf called a prothallus. And on the surface of that, it then produces a male structure and a female structure. Again, you need water present to unite the two. And then once it's been fertilized, then it can actually grow what most people would think looks like fern. So the first kind of frond emerges out of that. And so it's really a plant that needs to have just the right kind of conditions to be able to do it on its own. That said, growing them yourself really isn't very difficult. We've got a really wonderful tip sheet on our website called Growing Ferns from Spores that was written by Bill Kalina when he was here at New England Wildflower Society. And really what you need is patience. You need to be able to collect the spores, and there's tells you how to do that. But the most important thing is sterile conditions. And so, you know, you can take a small pot of soil. He recommends microwaving it. And then you sow the spores onto the surface and then close the whole thing up into like a Ziploc bag, or, you know, creating like a mini greenhouse. And then you put it on a sunny window and you wait. And within weeks, you'll begin to see what looks like little green fuzz on the surface. And those are those little prothalli that I talked about. And then, you know, within, you know, 10, 11 weeks after you've sown it, you should be able to see the beginnings of the new fronds emerging. And when they're big enough to handle, you can take them out of the bag and divide them gently and then grow them on as you would a normal plant. They don't grow fast, so, you know, you definitely have to have patience, but it's not as difficult as people might expect it to be.
Another thing that I noticed in the garden is that certain species, I mentioned that some just sort of seem to appear lustily. But sometimes I notice with painted fern, with Japanese painted fern, not a native fern, obviously, I see babies. I was going to say seedlings, but of course they don't have seeds. They have spores, so they're not seedlings. But I see little babies, volunteers, in the cracks and crevices adjacent to the area where the adult plants are growing. So it's funny that some of them do seem to sow themselves around successfully, even in a garden setting. And probably if I didn't clean up as much in certain areas, I'd have more that made it.
Well, I mean, because that again speaks to the you know, extreme microclimate in the crevice and crack in between the rocks is probably just sheltered and moist enough for the painted ferns and its spores to undergo this, you know, very sensitive early period and then be able to start growing new fronds. You know, it definitely does happen, but it's sort of a cryptic process because it's a stage of life that many people don't actually witness because it's very tiny and it kind of happens like, you know, underneath and hidden from view unless you're really trying to go out and look for it.
So let's say it was getting to be fall. I guess probably is that when a lot of them sort of ripen these spores is later in the season?
There's a whole range. So
okay.
The very first one to come ripe is interrupted fern.
Oh yes.
Claytonia. And that's ripe already as soon as May. And then it extends all the way through till late November when our climbing fern becomes ripe. What you need to do is to, you know, you have to check them periodically and kind of like you do a spore print. You clip a frond, you bring it indoors, you put it on a piece of paper and somewhere where it's not drafty, and then you wait overnight and it dries out and then we'll leave a spore print on a piece of paper that you can then tip into a little envelope and you're good to go.
Okay. So those are the ones that have, is it called sori? What are the little dots on the back of the fronds called that have?
Yeah. The spore bearing structures are called sori.
Right.
Some of them have a little covering, sort of like a thin white covering on the top that's called an indusium.
Right.
It's going to kind of peel away. And then when they looks brown, then it's usually good and sort of a darker brown. Some of them may start off more of a tan color, which means they're not quite mature yet. But once they've turned a good dark brown color, that they should be ready to be harvested.
Okay. So then I have an obsession with, speaking of ferns that like to take over territory, I love ostrich fern. And that has a different way of making its spores, I think, with fertile fronds. Is that correct?
Yes. So this is a great distinction to make. So some ferns will combine the fertile frond with the frond itself, and then others will separate the two. So they'll make sterile fronds. So that's basically the solar panels for the plant, so they can capture light energy. And then they'll make a separate fertile frond, which looks very different than the sterile fronds, and that is entirely designed to create the spores and get them out into the environment.
So with my ostrich fern, I wouldn't find any of those little dots, those sori on the back of the green foliage, no, so to speak, but I might cut back one of these brown, and they're very persistent. Like I leave them up in the winter and they're beautiful. Yeah. And I would bring that in and put it on the piece of paper out of a draft.
Yep. Exactly. Okay. And, you know, the ostrich fern actually also makes really wonderful like winter arrangements. If you like,
yes,
seed head arrangements and those sorts of things with grasses. We oftentimes include ostrich fern because they're so architectural and they last a really, really long time.
They're fabulous. So it spreads, and maybe we can just quickly mention among some native ferns that you're crazy about. And of course you're in the Northeast, and some of these have a wider range that you may mention and some not so, but mm-hmm. some that others that spread a lot versus some are for some particular, some favorites of yours that are for particular types of conditions.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, I think that ferns as a whole are a very useful group in the garden. You can divide them into sort of two broader categories. The clump forming ones that will stay in one place and continue to make a larger and larger clump as they mature. And then the ones that actually have rhizomes underground that will run and spread. And so we've already mentioned sensitive fern. Hay-scented fern is one that can be particularly aggressive and one that you see in pretty great stands in the woods around.
Yes.
There is an unfortunate correlation that wherever you see lots and lots of big stands of hay-scented fern also means there's lots of deer present. ferns in general have silicates in the fronds, and the deer don't want to eat it. And so they'll eat everything else but the ferns. And have kind of so when you see those kind of landscapes and it looks kind of beautiful and park-like, it's because the deer have eaten everything else except the fern. So it's visually beautiful to see, you know, big mature trees and this understory of like unbroken hay-scented fern, but it's not a good long-term picture because there's no younger trees that are going to come up and replace because they've all been eaten off.
Right.
Sorry, as a depressing aside.
No, but I get it. I mean, the lack of diversity, and really all you've got is some of the older trees and then this fern, and that's it. Everything else has been chomped down on. Yeah.
Yeah. So, So hay-scented and sensitive fern. I'm a big fan of the what are called broad beach ferns, Thygopterus. They have these really neat kind of triangular shaped fronds. There's a broad beach fern and a long beach fern that also really, that they don't get very tall, maybe about a foot or so. And they really fill in very nicely, especially if you combine them with somewhat stronger growing perennials and things that can push up through and get a little bit above the ferns. Here at Garden in the Woods, we have a really wonderful display in the springtime of long beach fern, Phegopterus connectilis, with white wake robin, with Trillium grandiflorum, and pair wonderfully together. And they're all about the same height, and it's just a wonderful combination. So that's definitely a big favorite of mine. I'll give you one other one, which is a little bit on the unusual side, which is called Northern Oak Fern. Gymnocarpus dryopterus is its name. And it's absolutely darling. It grows about 6 inches tall and looks like a little mini bracken fern. And it's a really wonderful one to pair with more delicate combinations. So bunch berries or wintergreen, you know, smaller plants that, you know, aren't going to be, that would normally be overwhelmed with larger, stronger growing ferns.
Huh. I've never seen that. Gymnocarpus dryopteris. Is that what you said it's called?
Yeah. Gymnocarpium.
Gymnocarpium. Okay.
Yep. And then for clump formers, you know, I think a lot of the wood ferns, the Dryopteris genus, they're beautiful. They have this like almost vase-like shape. And, you know, there's many, many different ones to choose from. You know, Dryopteris marginalis or intermedia are really good for drier shade conditions. If you live somewhere where, you know, if you're at elevation or in the mountains, there are two good sort of mountain wood ferns, Dryopteris campyloptera and Carthusiana are two that have fronds that are almost sort of twice cut. So they have this really lacy, frilly appearance that I think are really fantastic. And then for wetter areas, things like royal fern, Osmunda regalis, which can almost grow in standing water and over time forms this really beautiful sort of dark brown root mass out of which the fronds emerge. You know, in marshes, this almost acts like it creates its own little hummock, and then other things seed into the root mass, and you almost have your own little ecosystem there, all thanks to one fern's presence.
Cool.
So those are just a couple of my favorites.
So those are some good ones. And again, some I don't know. So now I'm going to go madly look them up as soon as we're finished. So just to say quickly, of course, some of them, or another way to propagate ferns is asexually. We could propagate them by moving them around, either taking pieces of those rhizomes of some or taking a whole clump and so on and so forth. And which I do a lot. I tend to do it at the moister times of year, either early-ish in spring or sometimes even early in the fall, and keep them watered. But I tend to do that, and they do really well. Mm-hmm. But just in the last minute or two or so, you told me the other day about a fernery, that there's something called a fernery. Tell us what a fernery, because it was such an old-fashioned idea. Tell us what a fernery is.
Well, it is. It goes back to Victorian times in England, when there was sort of a craze for ferns, and a period where, thanks to the sort of colonial efforts of Europeans, there were lots of ferns being brought back to Europe from lots of different places in the world. And so to put them on display, they basically erected entire conservatories dedicated just to different kinds of ferns. So you had, you know, typical tree ferns and climbing ferns and all sorts of things. And they're really wonderful spaces to be in. And there's only one in the United States at this point. It's at the Morris Arboretum in the University of Pennsylvania. It's called the Dorrance H. Hamilton Fernery, and it's a really cool space. If you're ever in the Philadelphia area, definitely drop in and check it out, because there's just an amazing amount of diversity and texture of ferns, primarily tropical ferns. And then if you're ever traveling in Europe, you know, one of the things that I love to do when I travel is to visit other gardens. And there are loads of wonderful ferneries in England and Scotland and France. They're well worth seeking out.
I've never been to a fernery. So see, now that's on my bucket list. I've got to go to a fernery.
Well, I wish more people did them here, because they're really—
Yeah. Well, Uli, it's always fun to talk to you, and I hope we're going to visit again soon. And again, I'm going to give links to some of the classes and about the plants that are for sale at the various Native Plant Trust facilities and so forth, to encourage people to engage with this great and very historic organization in its own right. So thanks for making the time today. talk
absolutely.
To you soon.
As I said, it's always such a pleasure to speak with you, and I really relish the opportunity.
You're sweet. Well, thank you again.
Underwriting support by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, supplying landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners with new ideas and high-quality flower bulbs for fall planting. Plant tulips, plant daffodils, plant Color Blends this fall. Available at colorblends.com.
And thanks to all the rest of you for tuning in too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or Spotify. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening, especially with ferns, meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.